Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is January 26, 2023. And this is episode 363. I'm the host, Mark Ames, up here on Lake Ontario, Western New York. And I am on the line with the Warnerd himself, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. the Warnerd. And by the way, you're listening to Radio Warnerd. That's patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. First of all, hey, John, how you doing?
Hey.
Where are you?
I'm not in Tunis anymore. I'm in Hammamet, which is across the neck of the peninsula. The Tunis is on the left side of the peninsula, the west side. Hammamet is on the east side, and the ruins of Carthage are sort of toward the end, the northern end of the peninsula, and we're going to go see the ruins of Carthage tomorrow. And I'm really looking forward to that because, you know, Roman ruins, yeah, dime a dozen. But whatever's left of Carthage, that's Punic stuff, and that's not as common.
Yeah. Well, I guess since you were in Italy, you probably had enough of Roman ruins for a while, but yeah, Carthage. Yeah. Yeah. How much is left?
That's what I'm going to find out. I don't really know yet. I think human relations are going to occupy a lot of my time because we met the tour guide at a pub with English football flags all around it, and that promises to be a social intensive outing, but we'll see.
And God, I mean, we might have to do something on Carthage, right? I mean, you're going to go see it.
I want to do something on Carthage, but yeah. We'll need to prep, so I'll start prepping.
Yeah. So, John, before anything, I know you're in transit now. You had to leave what turned out to be your favorite city since we've started this show, which is Trieste. But you're now in Tunis, and you're going to be heading to the UK soon, and there's going to be a Radio Warnerd meetup there, right?
Yeah, and I want to announce that for everybody. Everybody's welcome to come to this RWN meetup in London on February 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old White Bean, or is it Bear? I'm sorry.
Old White Bean because I kind of feel like
probably
one.
Bear, huh?
Yeah.
The old White Bear pub. At any rate, it's a building that's at the number one, Well Road, W-E-L-L Road. And the postcode, which is more useful, is N as in Nancy, W as in W, 3, N-W-3, 1, LJ, NW31LJ, the Old White Bear Pub, One Well Road. And you get there on the Hampstead Underground or the Hampstead Heath Overground. And this is all thanks to friend of the show, Amelia Lees, author of Think Like a Vegan.
I have that book. Great book. Yeah, okay, good. So you're going to be in London by February, I guess. It sounds like you're going to be.
Yeah, we're going north to Scotland after that because, various reasons. But we're going to be in London for a while. And, yeah, we'll be there in case anybody wants to drop by, say hello on February 7th.
And we should have some friends of the show up in Scotland as well.
I think quite a number,
Yeah, so that should be. Are you going to Glasgow or Edinburgh? Or do you
the outskirts of Glasgow.
Okay.
I have to practice my Glasgow kiss.
I'm trying to think of bad train spotting jokes, which is the crudest thing I can think of when I think of Scotland. You know, short. Anyways, sorry. Right. So let's get going to our interview. I mean, last year at the sort of the year in review episode we did, it was the worst of times. That's the end of 2022. You talked about how you wanted to discuss more the incredible Department of Defense budget going up to $1 trillion, and nobody even batting an eye about it.
Nobody. It's frightening.
It is frightening. I mean, I even remember, you know, in the Reagan years when these budgets went up, there was at least a pretend pushback, you know, and outrage constantly. I mean, it was like a feature of you know, the next defense. And in fact, they kind of fed off of it, the Republicans. Ha, ha, ha. You don't like this budget increase and we're going to do it anyway. And now it's just sort of like, ugh, $1 trillion. Yeah.
If anything, it's the centrists who are pushing it hardest and the people who are trying to be obnoxious right-wingers who are grumbling about it. It's just too weird for me.
It is weird. In fact, we don't talk about this, but it seemed like the most controversial thing about the budget was that were the vaccine mandates.
Oh, yeah.
And the right fought hardest on that. I mean, they're talking about reducing the defense budget possibly, you know, or cutting it as part of like a general cut of everything in government. But those vaccine mandates had to go. And even on that, the progressives or the, you know, the center left caved. I mean, you know, I guess it's the least offensive thing in there, but it's kind of ridiculous that that's where the big battle was, you know?
Yeah. It's we are just, strange people. That's all you can
very
say.
Strange. I know. Right. So anyway, let's get to our interview with Andrew Coburn, friend of the show, former guest, and Harper's editor in Washington, D.C. All right. We are really honored to have back with us friend of the show, previous Radio Warner guest, Andrew Coburn. Andrew is the author of the book, Spoils of War, Power, Profit, and the American War Machine. So he's very obvious go-to guest for the subject that we're going to talk about today, which is the DOD budget. Anyway, he also has a great Substack that I subscribe to and I recommend you do too, called The Spoils of War. It's grim stuff, but has enough humor in it to help it go down. I mean, it's pretty insane stuff about the latest graft story out of Washington. And he's also been a guest on several Radio Warnered episodes. Let's see, episode 57, we talked about Yemen. Episode 191 on Pentagon sleaze. It's a favorite topic of ours. And episode 296 when his book, The Spoils of War, came out. Andrew is also the Washington, D.C. editor of Harper's Magazine. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be with you.
Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks very much.
So, getting to that $1 trillion baby moment here with the Pentagon budget. You know, I was going back through some of my older notes. And let me read this off to you. This is Washington Post, February 24th, 2014. So we're literally talking like a day or two before the Maidan revolution or coup. It was a coup. We call it a revolution. Anyway, this is February 24th, 2014. Headline, Pentagon blueprint would cut army size as military adjusts to leaner budgets. saved by the bell. Fortuna has blessed the regular weapons contractors. You know, there's just endless. I remember these stories, and it was like the timing was just so uncanny. The Defense Department on Monday proposed cutting the Army to its smallest size in 74 years, slashing a class of attack jets, rolling back personnel costs in an effort to adjust a department buoyed by a decade of war to an era of leaner budgets. What happened, Andrew?
Well, I think within a day, a day after the, whatever you want to call it, occupation, liberation, conquest of Crimea, I happened to be having lunch with a friend of mine who was a lobbyist, who told me that just that morning he had been at a fundraising breakfast hosted by Congressman Mike Rogers, important denizen of the military-industrial machine. Mm-hmm. And the other attendees were mostly defense lobbyists. So I said, what was the mood? What were they talking about? And he said, I'd call the mood borderline euphoric.
Wow.
Which is goes to your point. What happened? Yeah. What happened? You know, we have an $858 billion defense budget, up 10% on last year. I mean, by some yardsticks, you know, we already have a $1 trillion defense budget once you sort of throw in a few other things like national security-related things, including the interest on the debt that we accrue for all that.
What's been really remarkable as I was prepping for the show is that this doesn't seem to be big news in most places. You sort of have to go to the edges of the net to find any shock or even disturbance about it. And the figure itself, like, what are we talking about? That hasn't been featured much.
You know, I remember reading a book about the sort of financial collapse of Europe between World War One and World War Two, and talking about the German inflation. And as inflation sort of grew to like several thousand percent a day, people lost all sense of numbers. So they would start to say, well, I'm 47 million years old and things like that. and I think it's become like that, you know. Yeah. People have lost. It's so gargantuan. It's so vast that, you know, people sort of lost all grip. I mean, this year's budget, or the FY23 budget, is $80 billion up on last year, right? That's more than, you know, the defense budget, actually by some of Russia, I think.
Yes.
Certainly of, you know, Japan, you know, all sorts of UK. I mean, the only country that hasn't that the defense budget is not, the defense budget increase is not bigger than, is China, which, you know, our pacing threat. Remember the pacing threat? I love that phrase, the pacing threat, which is sort of limping along at $293 billion. It's just, you know, what do you want to do? Cry, vomit?
well, some of the basic questions, I mean, I'm not up much with journalism. I know I usually have to ask Mark, but I have a strong sense that there used to be defense correspondents at the major news sites. And they were kind of home team cheerleaders, but at least they had some knowledge of it. And I was looking for articles on the B-21, like, why are we still funding a human-piloted bomber, as you ask in one of your articles, in 2023, and that hasn't come up much. I mean, the best article I found was a 5-year-old blog by an ex-USAF colonel.
It's astonishing. There's this sort of rah-rah, you know, they were all flown out for the unveiling of the B-21 to Palmdale, and the defense correspondents all talked about its, you know, wonderfully stealthy characteristics and how sort of cool it looked and how cool the presentation was, you know, with all the blue lighting and,
I remember that on social media, all the journalists were just, they were openly, they weren't hiding it, because there used to be a slight sense of maybe this isn't socially correct to openly gloat and celebrate it, so I'll try to be a little ironic. There was none of that at all, just pure tongue out of the mouth gloating.
maybe for your audience, we don't need to go in what a ridiculous sort of pork laden.
Oh, let's do it.
Please.
Please.
It is. Yeah. You know, I mean, for a start, they're spending whatever, I think the program is currently pegged at $200 billion, $203 billion, which will be more. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't actually, you know, it's replacing the whiskered, you know, tired old B-2, which actually isn't that old. But as far as I can see, it isn't that much different. I mean, maybe, you know, there's some design features that have been altered, but it basically, you know, it won't be any more or less visible to radar.
Yeah, I noticed that the CEO of Northrop Grumman had a very telltale remark about the B-21. the stuff that you don't see is the best stuff, which right. It really well, requires a Emperor's New Clothes leap of faith.
Yeah, right. Well, as I remarked, that, you know, the thing is, stuff you don't see is actually what it's costing us, you know.
Yeah.
It's, for a while, you know, they tried to, they said that the actual cost, projected cost of this was classified.
Right.
It was because the Russians and the Chinese would say, aha,
yes.
You know, they're spending $200 million.
We could overspend too. Yeah.
But that might spur the Chinese to competition. In fact, I'm right. If I'm right in thinking, I think it took one of the few actually halfway competent defense journalists left, Tony Capaccio at Bloomberg. I think he was the one who told us, actually gave us the cost. I mean, actually got someone to tell him the cost, which we should all know already. So, you know, it's completely absurd. It's just the Air Force, amazingly, you know, how far are we from the, well, let's say, when did we have a invulnerable nuclear deterrent? With the Polaris missile, which came in, they were 1960 or something.
Yeah.
So that's 63 years ago. since then, we haven't needed ICBMs, and we certainly haven't needed strategic bombers.
Mm-hmm. No, but they got the triad supposedly became the ultimate guarantee of assured destruction. And the thing is that people believe and accept that this technology is evolving very quickly, but somehow they also accept that the triad is something like the military equivalent of the Trinity. It's basic doctrine.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And the I think you put the bomber down as the Holy Ghost, you know.
So. Right. That's what you don't see.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But it's and you know, in a way that this thing about the technology rapidly evolving, it is and it isn't. I mean, it's all in the, you know, microcircuitry and electronics.
Well, I think to the extent that in 1945 it might have been hard to, or 1955, you might have been able to design a bomber that could evade Russian air defense, especially with what we know now about Russian air defense at the time. But then, first of all, the high altitude became untenable because they could shoot down the U-2, which could fly as high as you wanted, and then programs like the B-58 got canceled because their whole mode was to go really high, really fast, and that didn't work anymore. And then it was terrain following, and that will work against low-tech opponents, and we've had a lot of low-tech opponents or poorly trained opponents, but it's not likely to work, and it's also not necessary to work because nobody can really stop a sub-launched ICBM. But now they've come up with yet another thing to extend the life of this weapons platform that has no real reason to exist, which is stealth. And whether you believe in stealth or not, it's at least hard to prove one way or the other.
Well, you know, here's the point about stealth. We, you know, what they talk about a lot is, you know, the magical coating that sort of, you know, sort of the invisibility cloak that this thing is supposedly made of, or the skin is made of, and all the special sort of roundy surfaces, you know, so that all the radar can be deflected. But actually, that's only part of what the sort of stealth concept is. The other thing is, the whole idea that you know where the enemy radars are, and the radio, you know, the enemy sensors, their defense sensors, and you sort of go around them, and so that's a huge part of the F-35, the whole program, and so there's a whole, you know, mission data set that's actually meant to be updated daily into the plane's software, you know, computer, so you know exactly where the Russians have moved, or the Chinese, or whoever. But it goes by region. So let's say we're talking about Russia or around Ukraine. You know, the Russians have got an air defense radar here, and there's a civilian airport there, and you know all the rest. So it has this sort of electronic map in its memory. And that all comes from an office at Eglin Air Force Base, who are meant to be in charge of sort of updating the things. And the last thing I heard, maybe slightly out of date, but they were 6 months behind. So
yeah, that was one of the most astonishing things you revealed in this series of articles you've done about the defense budget. I presume that's because it's not a sexy...
Right.
I mean, the word sexy is used in procurement circles, you know, very bitterly, ironically, well, very cynically, let's say. And I guess, you know, it's a few salaries. It's not worth funding. It's not going to make a lot of money for anybody.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, that's all, that, you know, it's, people think I'm sort of, you know, being a bit silly and sort of whatever when I say, but it's all about the money. It's always all about the money and nothing but the money. But that's a good example. You know, if it's not, if it isn't a big procurement contract or something that looks good in a Super Bowl ad, I mean, added benefit, which is the case with the B-21. I mean, I think they had a Super Bowl ad for the B-21 before the B-21 was actually sort of made. Yeah. You know, they were, it was first that the commercial came first. And then the, and you remember with the B-2, the first we saw of the B-2 was a Toyota commercial. Toyota figured out what it was probably going to look like and sort of made an ad. So we had the ad and then we had the real thing, which was invisible.
Well, right. Yeah, this corruption is right out in the open. Like one of the few sites I found is by a retired USAF colonel, William Astor.
Oh, yeah. He's pretty good.
Yeah, and he was actually breaking this down 5 years ago. He said... the lead contractor of the B-21, Northrop Grumman of Falls Church, Virginia. And I thought, oh, God, Falls Church, Virginia, really? And then United Technologies of East Hartford, Connecticut, BAE of Nashua, New Hampshire, Spirit Aerosystems of Wichita, Kansas, Orbital ATK of Clearfield, Utah, Dayton, Ohio. I mean, all these towns with... Mm-hmm. No doubt powerful senior Congress people who get dropped a little cash in the process.
Well, here's the point about that map. I remember that, which was, it was also came out with the POGO project on government oversight, which is, that was when they were still saying the total cost was classified, but they were saying where the pork was going.
Right.
You know, and you're right. I mean, all those major, major contractors, the prime contractors for this thing, were all carefully situated in the districts of important congressmen and senators. It was an egregious case of political engineering.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that if they were really worried about Russian and Chinese spies, they wouldn't tell them where all the different components were being made. Yeah. Here's a map where you can go, you know.
Yeah. Of course, what they hope, and the point is, what they hope and pray for is for the Chinese to come up with B-21. That would be just great.
Right.
One of the things that gives me hope that we might prevail over the Middle Kingdom is that the Chinese at one point went to all the trouble of stealing all the data on the F-35. This is like in 2008 or 9, I think there was a major hack and some Chinese electronic intelligence unit got away with, you know. This whole thing. And
flightless F-35, as we call it.
Yeah. Yeah, right. But I'm sure they were sped on their way. I mean, I'm sure it was made easy for them. Probably got sent the password because, you know, we want,
one, two,
we want
three.
Them to do that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. The bombers that it's replacing, it's a pretty incredible story. I mean, it's not replacing the B-52. Nothing ever replaces the B-52 because that actually works.
Yeah.
And the B-52's one fault, if it has a fault, is that it sort of like the A-10, it doesn't have planned obsolescence built into it. And that is obviously probably its biggest fault from these people's point of view. But the B-1, and I'm old enough to remember what a big deal that was Reagan versus Carter, that Carter killed it at first and maybe was going to rise, and then Reagan, like, this was going to really be our big comeback. None of those even fly anymore. There's like a half a dozen that still fly or something. And even the B-2, it's hard to find any of those that fly, and only 20 were ever made. That's just...
Yeah, they were going to make 100, I think. And then
this is what
that's one of the ways you lie about procurement. You say, yes, okay, if we only make a few of these, it'll be really insanely expensive, like you'll faint when you hear it. But if we make a lot of them, boy, you know, they'll go down in price so much. And then, of course, that doesn't happen because they all need refits and repairs.
Right. The important thing to remember about the B-1 and the B-2 is the B-1 was the Republican bomber.
Right.
And the B-2 was the Democrat bomber.
Right.
And the B-21 is a bipartisan bomber.
Yes.
Well, that's right. I mean, something we can get onto and discuss about the defense budget. But it's, people say, the thumbsuckers lament the passing of the age of bipartisan consensus on Capitol Hill. We've got it in spades. I mean, it's totally bipartisan. With the defense budget, a very good example of bipartisanship, I thought, a fine, stirring example of bipartisanship, was when Rand Paul proposed a sort of oversight mechanism for all the junk we're sending to Ukraine and all the money.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was voted down 99-1.
Wow.
Overwhelming majority. And all he was asking for was something like they had in Afghanistan, the Special Inspector General, John Sobko, who, the Pentagon and State Department and USAID, the bureaucracy considered a royal pain in the ass, which he, glad to say he was. And Paul was suggesting something similar for Ukraine. And he might as well have, said he was in love with Putin or something.
I know. It's treason. Oversight is treason at the moment.
Yeah. In fact, the National Defense Authorization, the NDAA, it's become like our governing mechanism. I mean, there's a thing, it's going to pass.
Mm-hmm.
So the big thing is to get an amendment on whatever you care about in. And my favorite amendment is the Ginni Thomas Immunity Bill. Do you know about this? It's emerged that the wife of Justice Clarence Thomas is this sort of demented right-winger who was, taking a leading part in the effort to overthrow the 2020 election and was egging deep in the planning for January 6th.
Yeah.
And people were also pointing out the quite considerable sums of money she's hauling in. So stuck an amendment in the NDAA to say you couldn't investigate the families of senior members of the judiciary. Who do they have in mind? So it's called, in Washington, they called it the Ginni Thomas Immunity Bill.
Wow. And that was added in the
Defense Act. Yeah, because it's going to pass.
Yep.
So as soon as you can persuade the leadership, to let them get your amendment in, you're home free.
There was one comment in one of your articles. These are the recent articles about the defense budget by Andrew Coburn said something to the effect of the defense industry is the American industry. So
the defining defining feature. I mean, I took it. Defining component of the U.S. economy.
You can actually claim that aside from what happens in war, where a tiny quantity of very expensive weapons obviously will not work for very long, you can say even in peacetime, this is good for America because it's really the only thing we do anymore.
Right. I mean, I took that quote from, it was an article by Lauren Thompson, kind of a sort of consultant of easy virtue for the Lockheed and various other people.
Right.
But it was pretty interesting. And he actually goes through, the particular, not the, the some of the states. I mean, he talks about Arkansas and a couple of others where the state economy is pretty much totally dependent on defense spending. I mean, you know, so it would be reduced to sort of practically Haitian levels if it if they lost these defense contracts. I mean, he was making the point, which he thought was just great, that what a lock defense spending now has on the economy, and just we cannot, if we ever could, but certainly cannot now do without the permanent war economy.
I was looking at some articles on the NDA that passed at the end of last year, this giant, you know, let's say $1 trillion budget that passed.
Yeah.
You know, one of them here, so the, it passed the Senate 83-11. And I think, you know, an 8% increase over 2022. 8% jump is, I'm not even sure that includes the Ukraine spending, I'm not sure, but 8% jump is the sort of shocking jump levels that happened under Reagan in the early mid 80s, as I recall. People were like, about 10%, I guess, under Reagan. I mean, this is, or like after the war on terror started. Like, these are massive, massive increases. And what's interesting is in this article here I'm looking at, so it goes through, you know, the all the different things that are being increased. And the first quote from a lawmaker is Chuck Schumer, Democrat, Senate Majority Leader. And what does he say? Quote, China is actively trying to undercut American interests and partnerships. So it's about China, which is interesting, you know, because I don't know, it's weird. I mean, the Russia invasion has kind of, it's both scared people, or it has shut people up who maybe oppose this sort of thing. And so it silenced a lot of voices. But at the same time, it should also say, you know, Russia spent 8 months trying to take Bakhmut.
Yep.
And, you know, they might get it, but like, how can we pretend that they threaten right, all of Europe? So it's China now, right?
Yeah. Right. It's, the pacing threat is the key. I mean, I went to there was a sort of defense industry conference I went to a few weeks ago, sponsored by one of the Politico offshoots, Politico National Security, whatever. And they had, you know, this panel, and it was quite a heavy-hitting sort of panels of speakers, you know, the chief of staff of the army, the senior Pentagon guy in charge of China, and various senior congressional types. And it was actually terrible. It was, at the same time, mind-numbingly boring, because they all sort of chanted these platitudes, at the same time terrifying, because occasionally I'd sort of wake up and hear someone saying, it's not a matter of if, but when we have the war with China.
Wow.
And I mean, variations on that remark, you know, all day long. I mean, I was...
That's insane. Do they really... I hate asking that question, but I got to ask it. Do they really believe that? Do they really think like that? I mean...
It's... Yeah, I mean, I also asked myself that question.
I'm a sucker for that question too. I always want to ask that, like, what happens when they go home and they're talking to their near and dear ones? Is it the same tone?
They'd occasionally remember to add the tagline, "If deterrence fails."
Right.
But in a way, I mean, it comes to a really important point, which is, supposing you say, okay, do they believe it? If they really believed it, then, for example, why do they spending, you know, gajillions of dollars to send build aircraft carriers to go close to China, where they'd be, you know, everyone agrees they'd be sent to the bottom in fairly short order.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in the one way, they sort of profess as this fervent sort of faith, deep-rooted faith in, you know, the coming war with China. And at the same time, the sort of refusal to connect that with actual possible military realities. You see what I'm saying? That it's. I think maybe there's some filter in the brain that when you say war with China, that actually means it's like a sort of, you know, hash in, you know, encryption, which actually is a, you know, the hash code translates into a password and so that. I've been learning about this because I've been following the tribulations of Julian Assange, and this is the one of the main accusations. But anyway, they so I think when they say the coming war with China, I think that's in their, that's actually a translated their brain into bigger defense budgets.
Yes.
War with China doesn't actually mean war with China.
Mm-hmm.
It means vaster, ever vaster defense budgets forever. Yeah. You know, for
and when you really want to dream about a particular war, you always create a scenario where it will go to this level, but it won't go to 11, as in, well, China feels truly threatened, so it just decides to wipe out that part of the Pacific in which the fleet is known to be.
Right, right. You know, it reminds me, there was one of my sort of favorite books about, you know, got us into this situation, is a book called The Air Force Plans for Peace, which I urge you to try and get hold of, which is about the Air Force's fight for independence during the war and immediately afterwards, by a guy called Perry McCoy Smith, who, amazingly, his career survived. He was an Air, he became an Air Force general. Anyway, he, and in it, he happens to remark that at the end of the war, the, they were looking around for what this air force they'd been planning to have, independent air force, what it would actually sort of be for. And they thought, would it be, you know, to defend against Russia, to attack Russia? And they said, well, Russia isn't a serious power because it doesn't have a strategic bombing force. So, and the Navy, meanwhile, was saying Russia isn't a serious power because it doesn't have aircraft carriers. You know, they were they could only think in sort of mirror images themselves.
Right.
But then they, but then they'd read in the papers about this thing called the United Nations that was being created, and they said, "Well, what is the mightiest power?" Obviously, United Nations. If you have world government, then what do world government need? Law enforcement. And what is the most potent instruments of force in the world? It's the United States Strategic Bombing Force. So we can be the UN police force. That was the whole,
Wow. It's, so that's kind of the genesis of it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Bureaucratic needs drive a lot of this. There was an interesting piece I saw on Pogo. When we were kind of preparing for this, I read some stuff from Pogo, which you've talked about and recommended as well. And this was a piece last from their blog section called The Bunker. This was last November, I'm sorry, December 14th, 2022, about the what's supposed to be the successor to the V-22, you know, the tilt rotor program. And they, so they've come up with this new boondoggle, which is the V-280 Valor.
Right.
And it's a, you know, it's going to be, it could lead to, let's see, could lead to $70 billion in U.S. and overseas sales. So it's a huge thing. This is a huge thing. And they go on about it and everyone's, you know, most people will sort of argue, you know, was Boeing's version better than the other guy's version? And, you know, do we definitely need this or do we not need this? But sort of way, way down in the article, they said, well, if they didn't come up with this, then... was the Army's airborne sort of fleet would be, or it's like a whole section of the Army would be cut out because.
Right. So yeah, the Army is defined as, I mean, it can have helicopters without helicopters or something that can be called a helicopter.
Right.
It's not supposed to have any air force.
Right, right, right. They're not allowed fixed wing.
Right.
The, I mean, interesting, the that program, the Valor, it's to replace the Black Hawk, you know, the UH-60, which is the, you know, the backbone of, you know, it's what they use to move troops around. It's what they use to take troops into when you're landing, you know, into an LZ, a landing zone, inserting troops somewhere, you know, maybe under, you know, in combat conditions. This will be the thing. I mean, I'm actually... very interested in this because the Marines, you remember, they came up with the Osprey with the the V-22, which killed a whole bunch of Marines. As a result of which, so I'm informed, basically, if you try and come down too fast, it crashes, or very likely to crash. which is what you want to do if you're landing somewhere where there's opposition. People are shooting at you.
Right.
That is an inherent problem that can't be solved. I mean, you can't, so there's no fix for that.
Right.
Once you have these rotors side by side for various reasons I can sort of, I've vaguely begun to understand, it becomes inherently unstable and you think can flip over and anyway, everyone gets killed. So they, nevertheless, the army is pressing ahead, is ordered, you know, is going to go have this tilt rotor replacement for the Black Hawk, which will, you know, I can guarantee you we'll all be, you know, in 10 years' time, we'll be talking about the disaster of the Valor. I mean, the army, poor old army, it's always coming up with new helicopter ideas, which always turn out to be disasters. There's something about the army that they just can't get things right. I mean, just on the other end of the scale, they keep trying to design and come up with a new radio for troops to carry, kind of important, basic. and the latest one, it gives the one of the things, the problems with it, the battery is so hot because they're giving it this very powerful battery that it gives the troops sort of second degree burns.
Oh my God.
So, it's like, you know, they can't even come up with a decent radio that works in a city.
Some other stuff that's just so crazy about this, less than half of the V-22 fleet today existing of the 350, less than half can be flown at any time because there are 70 different V-22 types among the 350 flown. So the maintenance, I mean, everything, spare parts, maintenance, it's all just a jumble and a mess. And we'll get into the weapons that we're shipping to Ukraine soon.
Yeah.
But, you know, you read these things and you just wonder, it's a damn good thing that the U.S. has not fought an enemy that can fight back except, you know, from its own home country all these years, because you really wonder what's going to work and what
won't. You look at the F-35, which is kind of like the lead standard, if you want, of, you know, procurement disasters, the Marine Corps, one of its fetishes ever since it bought the Harrier way back in the Falkland War years, is short takeoff and landing. And nobody else particularly wanted that. They wanted a very high-tech, top-of-the-line plane. But the Marine Corps insisted on that. So there's a separate Marine Corps version with short takeoff and landing. And that imposes massive design costs on all the other variants, because it's supposed to share a single airframe. And this has been a scandal called gold plating for years. Every service wants to add its particular fetish. And every one of them has many, many fetishes. And they're all lucrative. They make a lot of money.
I mean, the Marines are who gave us the F-35 because it started with them. And they insisted on this vertical takeoff capability, which means, in turn, meant the plane had to be fat because you had to have, you know, enough intake so that it could go up and down in the manner prescribed. So, you know, meant for a start, it was, you know, that killed it as a sort of a halfway decent fighter.
It always reminds me of the vehicle that the Griswolds take in National Lampoon American Vacation.
Yeah. It's amazing.
I'm curious, do the Brits still use a Harrier, or that jet that so bedazzled everybody in Washington and every war nerd, you know, in 1982-83? Do they still use a Harrier?
Yeah, they've still got a few Harriers left. I mean, but the Brits, you know, they bought the F-35, and actually someone's been sent, a British naval person has been sending me papers showing just how catastrophic. I mean, none of them work. They had to, they went to their new aircraft carrier, the Queen Elizabeth, went on a cruise to the Far East last year. And they had to borrow a Marine F-35 unit because so few of their planes were operational.
One of the weirdest things about the history of procurement is that things that originally began with a contractor's promise to do leaner, cheaper planes, tanks, weapons of any kind, always ends up costing money. Like in the case of short takeoff and landing, STOL, vertical takeoff and landing, VTOL, the idea was one of the many fictions of the NATO-Warsaw Pact war, which we haven't been willing to face, is they're going to crater our runways and all of these expensive planes won't be able to take off. That was one of about a million, you know, little problems they had with the whole scenario, which was always fiction. But they said, so we'll come up with these lean, mean, cheap, fast takeoff and landing planes. Mm-hmm. And they were not cheap and they did not work. But it made a lot of money for some people.
That's right. You know, the thing about vertical takeoff thing is you're building the defense of the airfield into your aircraft. Instead of trying to defend a long runway or whatever, you're basically doing away with the runway and you're sort of investing all that in this capability, which...
I admit I'm a fan of Cold War art, you know, those paintings that were commissioned by, Northrop Grumman and companies like that. And they showed these planes taking off from, you know, little highways in the middle of Belgium with an astonished Renault looking at this plane going up.
The Cold War art, that's a good... We should have an exhibition of that.
Yes. Yeah.
There is occasionally I get emails. There's some people trying to set up, I don't know, I must check in actually, a Cold War museum on the Mall. You know, we have the Vietnam Memorial, we have, and we have the World War II Memorial and the
Korean War Memorial.
And then they want a Cold War Memorial with a little museum.
Mm-hmm. When we get back to the question of belief, and I know it's a naive question, but I keep coming back to it too. It's like, if there were an existential threat, I think everybody sort of knows what production would look like in that situation. There would be a lot of money put into supply. There would be simplification of weapon systems. Mm-hmm. So I always wondered, does this gold-plated few specimens of fancy, expensive stuff, does it mean nobody's really afraid? Nobody's really preparing for war?
Yeah, it goes back to the question about do they actually believe in war with China? They tell themselves they are. I mean, there was a thing I just wrote something about it, this report, which is causing a lot of talk in Washington from CSIS about, it's called Empty Bins, and it actually goes through, basically lays out how supplying Ukraine has, you know, really emptied out basically all our ammo stocks, or is in the process of doing that, which the author then says, and this leaves us very sort of naked and afraid in face of the China threat. And how can we really have a war with China when we've pissed away all our ammunition on the war in Ukraine? I mean, to summarize what it says, but of course, which he then, being a dutiful member, fully paid up member of the military industrial complex, he says, therefore, we need to have more of a surge capacity. We need more ammunition factories, and just basically got to put even more money into the, into defense production, and particularly ammunition and so forth.
Isn't that happening? I mean,
they are doing. Oh yeah, and we should. It's worth mentioning, you know, what they're doing and using Ukraine as the excuse is to getting, you know, what the contractors have always wanted is multi-year procurement. Mm. At the moment, they have to say, you know, okay, FY23, you have umpty billion to buy X amount of whatevers. Now they want it to be able to say, you know, for the next 10 years, it's going to be like, you know, an entitlement like Social Security or something. You're going to have, you know, you are guaranteed to have X billion a year to buy, you know, this, that, and the other thing. I mean, shells, rockets, missiles, planes, tanks. I mean, the moment they do that just for like aircraft carriers, that's a sort of a big a trend which they're going to succeed in, you know, is to so all what really vestigial oversight we have will sort of go away for a lot of things, and then, you know, there'll be a permanent defense budget.
Right, and you pointed me to an article in Responsible Statecraft as well about how, for example, contractors doing Ukraine, you know, weapons work, a lot of them now are not required by the to provide the Pentagon certified cost and pricing data. That is to say, they don't have to say how much is. I mean, there's no oversight. It's like, we'll bill you when we're done. We'll come up with it and bill you when we're done.
Exactly.
And even on the same things that they've already been selling to the Pentagon for years now, it's like, oh, no. Now we're not going to tell you the cost. We can't tell you till we've delivered it to you, even though we've already sold it to you at X cost all these years. Like, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
In a way, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, as you said earlier, that the, you know, it's China. It's all about China. But I mean, can't they be just satisfied with one war? You know, given them a really war they're making a lot of money on, you know, it seems greedy to be demanding two.
Well, this is another one of those questions about consciousness, and I know they're amateurish, but I keep wondering, was there something like a sense of disappointment in the lobbyist world when the Russian army turned out to be such a flop? Like, you know, you're trying to take a dive for somebody and you just tap him like Jake LaMotta does and it falls down. It's ruining the game.
When that happened, you know, in the early 90s, what they tried, first of all, was, you know, we were menaced. We were now in a multipolar world with many near-peer competitors or non-peer competitors. And, you know, it was kind of dangerous to have. I think that's when they started wheeling on the Iranians and the North Koreans and the, and then, you know, but then China came along. And so, you know, China was promoted to, you know, to number one near peer competitor. That was already happening in the 90s, actually, amazingly.
Right.
Then Putin, you know, Putin's been a great help because Putin was modernizing and he was putting money into the military. And look at the Russians, they, you know, doing much better. It's all sort of different now, and they're sort of cleaning things up. And we heard a lot about the Gerasimov Doctrine. Do you remember the Gerasimov Doctrine?
Yes, I know.
So they, you know, the Russians have been slowly put back on their feet, or gradually, fairly rapidly now. But
they fixed our elections, you know, they with Facebook ads or something.
With $100,000 in Facebook ads, they managed to elect a U.S. president. So they, and then it's been very, it's interesting, sort of schizophrenic thing, because with the Ukraine war, on the one hand, the Russians have been, oh, they're hopeless and, you know, we're winning, and Putin's failing war and everything. On the other hand, they're still a threat. And somehow they've been quite successful getting people to hold these wholly contradictory ideas in their mind at the same time. But that's a part of the reason I think there is for the popularity of China. Because the Russians might let us down by collapsing totally.
That seems to be the problem with the two threats. It's Russia is just not formidable enough, and China seems quite formidable, but not in a way that you really want to get in a war with on their own coastline. So really, neither of those scenarios works out very well.
Well, with Russia, you know, it's compensated. On the one hand, you know, hopeless, you know, these hapless conscripts, all that, and failing against Ukraine. On the other hand, Russia is ruled by this mad megalomaniac, Putin, who wants to conquer the world. So they sort of balance a bit there, I should think. Who knows what he'll do?
That's true. There is a great,
great
faith in sort of the Biden world, in the sheer power of malice, like, look, they got Sauron in charge. A few orcs might mess up, but it's still Sauron.
Well, that was the Saddam Hussein sort of game plan too, right? Like, sure, Iraq is weak, but he's so crazy.
Yeah,
we got to do something about him. Yeah.
Right. Well, that idea was developed a bit in the late 80s when the Soviet Union was visibly falling apart. And there's what I call the mangy bear thesis, The Russian bear was, you know, getting mangy into the Northeast. But, and actually this was seriously propounded by Andrew Marshall, you know, the very powerful person in the Pentagon for years and years, that this would, as they sort of fell apart and they would lash out in a final sort of spasm to conquer the world. And therefore Russia was even more dangerous now that it was on its knees.
I've seen a lot of that in the last 5, 10 years too about Russia
but
today.
There's a problem with that, it seems to me, just like as a naive consumer of defense news, which is they've proven they can't lash out very well unless you actually believe they never meant to take Kyiv, which is kind of ridiculous, because they're not going to take Paris or Antwerp if they can't take Kyiv. But at the same time, they can lash out. If you're serious about lashing out, that means nukes. And you don't have to be a strong power. The NATO tanks could be 35 miles from Moscow, and they could lash out in that way.
The Russian threat will never go away. That's one of the beauties of the whole thing.
But if they did lash out in that way, it would not be good. It would not be good for anybody.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that, I mean, even without the what you're just talking to say about, you know, nuclear lash out, implicit in why we, you know, why we have to throw everything, sacrifice everything on behalf of Ukraine, implicit is, you know, to stop Putin, that Putin, you know, will march on to Berlin, to Paris. You know, it's like, which, no, as you just said, he couldn't even take Kyiv.
No, that's what they say. If we let him come away with what even he thinks is anything less than a defeat, then he will, even though defeated, but he won't think it's a defeat in this thinking, he will still then therefore go on marching on to Stockholm and Berlin and Oslo and whatever else. Like, he has, the way the rhetoric is he has to know he's defeated and has to accept it. So even if it's a bad deal, it's not good enough unless he acknowledges.
This is the rub their nose in it theory, which shades into genuine loathing for Russians as Russians. And it's weird because it's propounded by people who often teach the Versailles Treaty to their students. Yes. And the lesson is, this was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, one of the features of this miserable situation has been the, you know, how these so-called people we used to think of as sort of, or we were meant to think of as vaguely on the side of the angels, like the Greens, you know, green, good.
Yes.
And you have this demented German foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, who's, you know, sounds like, I don't know, sort of Tom Cotton or someone, you know, sort of, I mean, completely crazed. And the, the Greens and the War Coalition. And, you know, over here, the Democrats are definitely the war party. I mean, it's... The only voices of doubt seem to be coming from the Republican right.
I had to ask Mark about that in an email recently because I haven't lived in the U.S. for a long time, and I just asked, didn't there used to be an anti-war left? I could have sworn.
We've seen less and less of it, but I think it went away. If you remember, think back to 1990, 91. Bush only got his war in Kuwait, you know, the 91 war. I mean, there was a real battle in the Congress over that.
Right.
I remember Sam Nunn saying, this is not our vital interest, and people like him.
I think Kerry voted against it, if I remember right.
Yeah. Exactly. That may have been the last. But I would say we can sort of mark the passing of the anti-war left with the Kosovo, 1999 Kosovo. Remember, they were all... Again, it was only Republicans. You had a bit of the anti-war right. But the so-called left were all for it. So it's been gone. It's been dead for, let's say, over 20 years.
Yeah.
Right.
And Russiagate seems to have put it to another level as well. I mean, it is it's prepared the ground such that, you know, for a lot of people, this is an extension of Russiagate. I mean, but it prepared minds for we have to fight that battle. And, you know,
Putin, if you're, he gave us Trump.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Putin gave us Trump. And if we, anybody who even raises any questions about this is potentially a Putin asset.
So, oh, yeah. You
know, yeah. Crazy.
Well, there's an element of vengefulness in that, yes, too, because a lot of centrists took this with, they reacted with a gnashing of teeth and a real ferocity, a real hate. And this means if we do everything we can to supply Ukraine, we can kill Russians without having to send our kids. I think you use that phrase, Andrew, without sending our kids to get killed.
Trump, I mean, I've just been writing about in Harper's about the rise of Ron DeSantis, truly unappealing figure. And I got strong indications that Trump figures that one of the things that got him elected in 2016 was not, quite apart from Vladimir Putin, of course, but what got him elected was his strong stand against foreign wars, which he didn't do much about afterwards, was, you know, that he has a strong bet on the sort of isolationist strain in the Republican base. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be running quite strongly on that, because as opposed to the warmonger.
It's very DeSantis. Strange. I mean, the American public is very, I mean, my people, a weird people, a very weird people. Like, in the Republican base, as far as I can see, and I make a point of haunting comments sections where they're still allowed, there's a lot of anti-Asian hatred, quite a lot, among conservative white people who support Trump. But they don't necessarily want a war. They just want to be able to badmouth people. It really comes down to that. And Trump just badmouthed Elaine Chao, I think her name is.
McConnell's wife.
He called her. This would not even have gone over on the playgrounds of Oak Park Elementary, I swear. But he called her Coco Chow, and somehow that's anyway.
What? Okay.
So the centrists use China as a more effective, more plausible threat than Russia, and I think there is some ethnic hatred there too. It comes across more in the way that they shrug at anti-Asian violence than anything else. But the hatred is really focused against Asians on the sort of populist right, if you want to call it that. But they don't want the war. It's strange. I don't know what to make of it.
You know, the working class, they have a slightly more direct, since a lot of them sort of they all know someone or had a relative who joined up or was in the Iraq and Afghanistan years. So I think that might be part of an impulse to it.
Yeah.
If my suspicion is correct, you're going to have Trump running against the Ukraine war. I thought it was quite significant that when Zelensky came to speak to the Congress, that almost half the Republicans, House Republicans, didn't turn up.
Wow, really? Half of them didn't show
I'm pretty sure of that, yeah.
Yeah, there was a large number.
But it was very significant numbers. So, you know, didn't sit it out, just didn't turn up.
Yeah.
And then some that did refused to jump up and applaud when they were meant to.
Wow. And whereas among the sort of what would be or would have been in some other time, the kind of anti-war left or anti-militarist left wing of the Democratic Party or progressive wing, they couldn't even muster up the courage to send a letter saying, hey, we support this, but maybe we should talk. And that letter got leaked and they backed away and all pointed fingers at each other. Like, not even a letter could they manage.
Right. They got savaged and denounced. And then it turned out that was actually the administration policy.
Yeah, it was just sort of like unnecessary. It was just slapping them down just because they could and putting them in their place. It was pathetic.
Congressman Raskin, He was one of the last to sign the letter. He signed the letter, and then 2 weeks later, when it's published, he receives a ringing denunciation of the letter that he's just signed.
He should put himself on trial, you know.
Exactly. What happened was that they'd taken a decision for whatever reason early on that they wouldn't release it until they had 30 signatures, which was, you know, a bit silly. But anyway, and so that's why it took months to sort of get it out. Jeez. As they slowly accumulated signatures. And one of the last of which was Jamie Raskin, who then hardly is the ink dry when he turns around and denounces it.
Wow.
God. Yeah, that's just horrible. And that's how, anyway, that's how they lose, especially younger people.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's just gutlessness. Let's turn it slightly a little bit to the weapons that are being sent to Ukraine. The series of Game Changers.
Right.
Your newest really
good. Oh, that was very funny. And funny. Yeah.
Yeah, piece. More magic weapons for Ukraine. I just want to read just a little bit of it. I just want to read the opening paragraph if I can. News that the U.S. plans to send M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine makes clear that our proxy war effort is definitely divorced from military reality. Now, this is everyone's calling this time. This is the game changer. Anyway, the Abrams, by the Pentagon's own admission, demands intensive maintenance and highly trained crews. Furthermore, unlike any other vehicle on the battlefield, it has poor mileage and runs on jet fuel, thereby necessitating a whole separate fuel supply system. And it was put, it was Donald Rumsfeld under Ford, I guess, who forced the Army to buy this jet-engined monstrosity back in the 70s in order to save the failing Chrysler Corporation. The Abrams and the Leopards that the Germans have finally been bullied into donating are merely the latest in a steady progression of, quote, game changers. Magic weapons hailed by virtue of their supposedly superior technology as the key to Ukrainian victory. Early in the war, the Javelin anti-tank missile was cast in that role, followed by the anti-aircraft Stinger, then by the M777 howitzer, which was succeeded in turn by the HIMARS long-range precision strike missile and the Patriot air defense missile. And then, you know, one after another, they didn't necessarily change the game. So my little softball question here, but is the M1 Abrams and the is this one going to be the one that really turns it around or
maybe not, maybe not. Yeah. Especially as the, I mean, the Army kept saying, we don't think we should send the Abrams. We're not going to send the Abrams. We shouldn't send the Abrams because it's so unreliable. And actually, poor mileage, it's 3 gallons to the mile.
Mm. Wow. In my head, I thought 3 miles to the gallon. But no, 3 gallons.
To the mile, yeah. Yeah.
What is it? Does it have to have like a giant tanker truck next to it as it drives
in? Actually, funny enough, it's not a joke. When you're during Desert Storm 1991, where, you know, the M1 Abrams was present in large numbers, they actually had to put a sort of, basically send the fuel when they did that sort of left hook,
yes,
you know, round the Iraqi army. They basically sent a fuel depot with it. I mean, it was, they were very lucky to get, I mean, the Iraqis, if the Iraqis had broken, they did know about it. The Iraqis were trying to get to that, which they failed to do. But, you know, it shows how vulnerable it is. But they were so dependent, you know, such poor mileage that they actually, you know, basically had to have a tanker truck with them. And it's, I noticed, we're sending 31 Abrams in a year. You know, it's very, you can see what the deal was with the Army.
Right.
It's like one of those headlines that you see in the last decade, like Britain commits 500 Royal Marines to Latvia. Oh, okay. That should do it. You know, 500 Marines. Well, given the Russian army's performance in Ukraine, who knows? Maybe it would. But in connection with this, one of the trends that you reveal in the articles we're talking about is that it comes down to people, not so much hardware. This is from Andrew's article about magic weapons. As retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Danny Davis, an armor veteran, suggests in an instructive article in 1945, Ukraine already has about 1,700 tanks, which is not getting reported much. 1,700 tanks comprised largely of Soviet-era models from its pre-war arsenal, plus subsequent donations and captured. Davis makes clear that in tank battles, technological superiority contributes much less to victory than crew training. Mm-hmm. He states unequivocally that if the Americans and Iraqis in the 91 Gulf War, in which he fought in a tank battle, had swapped weapons, the result would have been the same. General Norman Schwarzkopf, U.S. commander in that war, said the same thing. That's really remarkable.
Yeah. Since I put that up, I've had comments, people saying, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. That would have been the case. And actually, someone wrote in, I had a comment from a reader that's pointing out that the Egyptians have 1,000 M1 tanks. We were speculating on how many of them might be running right now. Maybe not too many. that should make Egypt into a mighty military power ready to conquer the rest of the Middle East, but it doesn't seem to be doesn't seem to work that way. It's exactly the case, you know, but we have to claim that technology determines everything, which it quite clearly doesn't.
A big part of this war is sort of weapons export marketing, I imagine. But then in some cases, you wouldn't want to show off the M1 in a real battlefield situation. So, you know, you might really try and delay that as long as possible. So if they, you know, some of these weapon systems anyways.
But Russia was doing really well as a weapons commercial in Syria. Right. And now they've destroyed the brand.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, it's you notice that we sold a record amount of arms last year. They've just come out with the figures. It's higher than ever.
Wow.
The defense industry is pushing for, believe it or not, there are still some restrictions on arms exports. I was amazed to discover this. And there's a big push to sort of get rid of these irksome restrictions so they can sell even more overseas.
Because of human rights
Human rights, you know, the Leahy Act and things like that.
Because I read that the last NDAA, there were some members of the House that were trying to hold it up to include provisions about not sending weapons to the worst human rights violators. And they, of course, caved on that. I guess that was Democrats, and they caved on that.
Oh, yeah, of course. We got to keep Saudi Arabia armed against the Yemeni threat, for example.
Right.
In fact, you cited a book by someone called, I think, Seth Jones, and I ordered it after reading your articles. And it's I shouldn't get into this. It's a digression, but he wrote a book called Three Dangerous Men. And this is what the Yemen war looks like from, I guess, the Pentagon or the lobbyists associated with it. There's absolutely no mention of the fact that Saudi Arabia decided to intervene in a civil conflict in Yemen. It's all about, look at what these Houthis, who are nothing but Iranian puppets, have done to our friend Saudi Arabia. It's extraordinary. And, you know, speaking about consciousness, you get a sense of what a whacked out consciousness these people have.
Seth Jones, he's the author of this report saying the Ukraine war has run us out of ammunition and weapons, and we have to get ready to be able to have a surge in defense production. I mean, I'm very glad you mentioned that, because it's as whacked out is the word. I mean, there's deep levels of insanity in these people, or I don't know, amorality, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So do you think going forward that these budgets are just going to keep ballooning at those levels? I mean, it's just mind-boggling to me that, you know, Biden came in, supposedly he was going to be the most progressive president
you believe
in history.
That? You believe that?
No, I didn't believe it, but I knew a lot of people on the left who wanted to believe it and therefore believed it. It was kind of crazy. And and he did put forward a big program, at least. I mean, usually the incoming Democrat cuts the program before Inauguration Day back to zero. But he, he actually pushed it for a few months into office and let people call him the new FDR, the new LBJ, like LBJ plus. And now we can't even get like daycare for working mothers, you know, children, like every country has it, let alone all the other things. But, you know, ponies galore, stuff that no one even seems to need for the defense industry. I mean, it's, where are we going forward? And it's like, have we reached a point in the It seems to me we've reached a new point in the empire where I don't recall this, seeing this before necessarily, where the empire, like the national security state, is overriding everything, including, you know, oligarch corporate interest with China. I mean, that, as far as I can tell, all this stuff about basically scaling back globalization, which has been, you know, to the American corporate world's benefit all these decades, they're scaling back globalization and trade. They're trying to scale back, you know, trade with China in particular. None of that can be good, I would imagine, for corporate America and a lot of the oligarchs. But it's a national security. The national security state seems to be leading now in areas that they hadn't really led before. And so I'm just wondering if we're really hitting this crazy new level with the empire, and if we're going to keep seeing crazier budgets like this.
We are going to go on seeing crazier and crazier budgets like this. Point one. Yes, I certainly agree with that. Mm. I'm not so sure corporate America is so defeated or, you know, has much to complain about here. I mean, trade with China was at a record last year. It's amazing how in the midst of economic warfare, things that are important to corporate America keep going. Like, for example, only 10% of American, Western firms, a lot of them American, have pulled out of Russia.
Right.
I mean, I was amazed to see that.
Yeah.
You know, with China, I mean, you know, Apple, I keep seeing things saying it would be impossible for Apple to pull out of, you know, to disengage from China, move its production base from China, though they occasionally make noises about it. In a way, it gives me heart. Maybe corporate America is the last bastion against war. yeah. You know, at the same time, corporate America, a lot of corporate America is defense corporate America. So yes. They're happy. As long as we can tick along like this, and unfortunately, you know, mothers with children needing daycare and, you know, food, and well, they're going to get short shrift. And obviously there's an looming assault on Social Security, which people ought to be thinking about. The deglobalization thing, I'm not so sure about
that. You
don't buy it? It still seems to be doing pretty well. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the whole this effort to cut off any kind of dependence on Chinese technology. Mm-hmm. So we're bribing, you know, giving the Intel Corporation, which is a sort of not exactly moribund, but it's sort of, you know, doesn't innovate anymore. It's not a, it's a decline, you know.
Right.
We shouldn't be subsidizing Intel, and I think we're giving them what, $52 billion to build a plant or something. it's propping up its kind of, you know, corporate welfare, which corporations obviously like.
Right.
But I don't know. I mean, I don't see too much that U.S. corporations need to be unhappy about or might be unhappy about.
That's a good point.
I mean, all these weapons are very profitable, whatever else they are. But you can see, if there ever does, I have no idea, but if there's ever a serious war against China or any other power that can rise to a level where they can have parity in all weapons and strategies, then it might turn out that the U.S., in a way that's sort of reminiscent of 17th century Spain, has invested a lot in weapons that are geared to domestic constituencies in a pork barrel way. And so we're going to go in with into a war that will be dominated by missiles and drones with piloted aircraft and aircraft carriers, and that won't turn out well.
Yeah, certainly not. But the take heart from the fact that the Chinese, you know, seem to be developing along rather similar lines.
that is true. It's one of the puzzles to me. Like, why is China stealing F-35 plans and building aircraft carriers? Why would you do that?
Because I think it's a very important question. I think it's because military industrial complexes develop in the way they do without necessarily having much relation to the military threat they face, or, you know, or being allegedly being designed to face.
Mm.
Why is the Chinese military designed the way they do? Why, you know, is it to reinforce Xi Jinping's sort of political position? I'd say, yeah. To assuage various, you know, business interests or, you know, special interest groups in China, who, for, you know, their own domestic reasons, are making the demands they are. Do they really care about whether they capture Taiwan or not?
Right.
In 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the Pentagon was convinced it was our spending that had defeated them. We had spent them into the ground because they'd been forced to try and compete with our spending, and that had, you know, bankrupted them. And so there was a study set up by Andrew Marshall, basically to verify this, to go and talk to all the sort of leading national security types in the Soviet Union to hear what they had to say about what had been going on. So the duty was a fascinating study. But it turned out their initial report was all these national security types said, oh, well, it had nothing, really had nothing to do with what you guys were up to. It was all due that we had 18 different kinds of missile systems because we needed employment in the cities where they were made. You know, party interest groups representing them demanded this. And so he said, that's what they bankrupted. It was nothing to do with what you were doing. So they came back, the study group came back and report, made their initial report at the Pentagon, whereupon it was abruptly cancelled because they were coming up with the wrong answer.
Yeah, that hit a little too close to
home. Yeah. So it's, you know, I mean, when we look at what the, you know, I mean, even, you know, sensible types like us, you know, we look at China and, you know, we tend to think of them sort of reacting according to national security concerns. But actually, I don't think so.
There are a lot of counterexamples, like why did Germany build up a gigantic surface fleet before World War One, which never did much of anything, when the U-boat was obviously a more effective weapon for what they needed to do. Because there was a constituency for that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You could find copious examples throughout history for that. I think it's always the case. My favorite example is Pericles basically kicking off the Peloponnesian War, or the sort of precursor to the Peloponnesian War, to do a favor for his girlfriend.
That's a constituency.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is there a system, before we finish up here, that you think, you know, taxpayers and military are getting their money's worth? I mean, the first one that comes to mind to me anyway is you know, the Warthog, the A-10.
Sure.
But I just saw in Pogo last month, I'll just read the little, what they're looking at. For the first time in a decade, Congress is not blocking Air Force plans to retire some of its A-10s. Yeah. So they're finally, I mean, in this grand bargain, it's like, okay, now let's cut the one thing that, God damn it, won't go obsolete on its own, like these beautiful B1s and B2s, which know when it's time up. So besides the Warthog, is there anything out there that—
Anything else?
I know. I mean, you've written about the Stryker, the Kevlar coffin, which we're sending like 100 of those to Ukraine. Good luck. Kevlar coffins.
I don't know. I mean, it's— It's hard to think of one. I mean, you know, things do work.
Like they were talking about F-16s are already the next game changer. I don't know if you've probably been
seeing
that.
Oh, yeah, 60 brace.
30 on deck is the next game changer.
You know, it was less good a plane than it was 30 years ago when it was designed. Going back to the A-10 for a second, when you talk to Democrats, I've ever talked to Democratic congressmen about how, you know, how can you cut this? So these would be left people. And then they say, well, if even the Pentagon wants to get rid of a weapon.
Like the last people you should listen to.
God. It's incredible. I mean, in 8,000 sorties, real combat sorties against in Afghanistan, people that we supplied ourselves with Stingers, only five A-10s have been shot down. Five out of 8,000 combat sorties.
Yeah.
I mean, General James Post once called any support for the A-10 treason.
He did.
Outright treason.
He did. He could never, I mean, these people, they're not only sort of lunatics, a lot of them, but they're incredibly, like there was a guy back Zeke Zoffler. It was an Air Force, head of Air Force acquisition in the 1970s or 60s, sorry, who declared that inefficiency is national policy. when someone said, why are you building this ludicrous, you know, load of crap that's going to take years to get, you know, said inefficiency is national policy.
Wow.
God.
We're going to outdo the Soviets at that too.
Yes.
That's the thing. Actually, reading this Mr. Jones's CSIS report, I was actually thinking about that report on, you know, the Soviet, what bankrupted the Soviet Union. I thought, God, we really are headed the same way.
Yeah. When I read your article about that, I tried to find stats on percentage of GDP, and the U.S. is now devoting, I think, 3.7% to defense, and China, something like 1.7.
Less than two. That's right.
Doesn't seem likely.
I think there are moves. I think some various people, younger yahoos in Congress, are calling for it to be written into law that we have to spend 4% of GDP or GDP on defense. I mean, it's a ludicrous yardstick anyway. I mean, you mean every time, say, you open a new McDonald's, well, that adds to the GDP. So therefore, the percentage of defense we're spending on defense goes down. Whereas if we have a thoroughgoing, you know, depression, then the defense, you know, will be better armed.
There's a lot of stick-ups at McDonald's, you know. You've got to do a heavy machine gun in that drive-through.
Yeah. You need close air support on that.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw this. The Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis released, this is so unbelievable they did this. And it's kind of weird the Fed would be involved. They released this graph to talk about, it basically is designed to demonstrate the China threat, the China spending threat, and to downplay, basically to show that our spending actually is perilously low. And so it's a graph. And the x-axis, of course, is time, so 92 to 2022. And there are two y-axes. One y-axis on the right that, you know, goes up, it starts at 400 billion and goes up to a trillion. And the American line on that graph goes along that. So it measures from 400 to 1 trillion. But there's another y-axis on the other side, which goes from zero to 250 billion. And to show that China's spending is actually going higher, so there are two lines, the China line red and the U.S. line in blue, are on the same graph, but the blue line, so the blue line actually trends lower because it's going not as fast towards $1 trillion, and the China line is straight up because it's going fast from 40 billion to 200 billion, and it looks like China is outspending us.
Oh, for God's sake.
I got to post this. It is the funniest thing, and it's from the St. Louis Fed. And if people called it out, like, how dumb do you think we are? Like, this is insane.
Well, pretty dumb. I mean, I frequent comment sections, and you would be amazed how many F-35 stories get a single comment over and over, which is, freedom isn't free. I mean, it sure as hell isn't. Freedom is free.
Debate stopper.
Yeah.
Sometimes the comment section in like serious papers like the Wall Street Journal can be interesting, but otherwise I just get depressed.
Yes.
Yeah.
By things like freedom isn't free.
Yeah. We like getting depressed here at this show. Yeah. So that's how we read it.
It's national policy.
Human depravity. Yes. It is national policy.
All right. Well, we've kept Andrew a long time.
So. I know. Thank you so much, Andrew, for coming on.
It is fun,
as always, talking with you. Andrew Coburn, the Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. Check out his always entertaining and sometimes enraging even Substack, which is Spoils of War, which is a spinoff of his excellent book, Spoils of War. Anyway, thank you again, Andrew, for coming on the show and taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, you're entirely welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay, we're back. You just heard some tunes. Sometimes people ask about this, a tune from our great sound engineer, our man Brendan. And Brendan, sometimes people ask where they can find, we have people ask where they can find your music. Brendan's a pretty darn famous musician in his own right. Anyway, Brendan, so where can they find it again? At thrilljockey.com?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll post a link to that too. Right. Anyways, John, before we go, once again, why don't you let people know about the Radio Warner meetup in London that's coming up at the old White Bean?
It's either the White Bean or the, well, anyway.
It's the Bear. I looked it up, but I really like the old White Bean.
Okay. Yeah, there will be a Radio War Nerd meetup on February 7th at 7 p.m. So, you know, 7th of February, 7 p.m. In London. And it will be at the Old White Bear Pub. I am told it is a bear. And that this pub is located at 1 Well Road. That is the numeral 1. W-E-L-L Road, 1 Well Road. And the postcode is NW31LJ, NW31LJ.
And the postcode's important because this is a giant city and the postcode tells you which part of this, like most people will know what that means, I assume, right?
I think so.
Their version of 90210 or something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, NW31LJ is notorious. I won't get into it. And you get there on the Hampstead Underground or the Hampstead Heath Overground.
All right. So, John, any last thoughts on the budget and all of that? I mean, I love talking to Andrew, so that was just a pleasure as it was. But, yeah.
Well, I want to add a little caveat to the oft-invoked cliche that freedom isn't free. Mm. Freedom isn't free, and it isn't a buck 09 either. Mm. If the F-35 is freedom isn't free, it's about $250 million per lousy plane.
I mean, I wonder if Lockheed is actually paying a strategic communications company to pay, you know, online trolls hired in, like, the Philippines, where they can pay him $2 an hour, to troll comment sections anywhere for any bad comments about the F-35 and then just to write in, freedom isn't free. I mean, I would like to believe that that's what's happening, but you and I know damn well that there are, that's homegrown stuff. There are people that get pleasure from that.
The only people who don't believe that, and they're quite numerous, are the people who have done a brain wipe on their high school experiences. I mean, if you went through high school PE, you know damn well who's saying freedom isn't free.
And putting it there, knowing it's going to piss off a lot of people, but they can't really say anything about it because that is a debate stopper in that faction of the comment section.
Yep.
Anyway, lovely country, John. You're missing out on a lot here.
I'm trying to.
All right. Thanks again, everyone. Thanks, John.
Thanks. Okay, bye-bye.